This is Sam Robson. It is March 27th, 2017, and I have the privilege of sitting here with Mr. Francis Abu-Bayor. We're at Connaught Hospital in Sierra Leone, in capital Freetown, and I'm here talking with Francis about his part in the Ebola response for our CDC Ebola response oral history project. Thank you very much, Francis, for being here. Can I first ask you, would you mind saying my name is, and then pronouncing your full name?
Yeah, my name is Francis Abu-Bayor.
Thank you. And what are you? What is your current occupation?
I've got a background in clinical training. I initially did community health in Jala. It's a three-year course with a one-year some sort of a housemanship. In that capacity, you can act as a medical assistant. And for 4 years, I was working with the Ministry of Health, wherein I was in charge of the whole chiefdom, basically acting like a general practitioner. You see cases, you can manage those, you can the others, you can refer. But then currently, I am in medical school. I'm doing medicine, and I'm in third year as of now.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And if you were to tell someone in just 2 to 3 sentences, very briefly, what your role was in halting Ebola, what would you say?
It started as a data input in person, but then I ended up acting as the local coordinator for surveillance during the response. So I was basically handling all I had to do with surveillance, which then had to do with like 3 key pillars: case investigators, people who are doing quarantine, and part of the social mobilization. That was basically my role before I left.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And can I now ask just when and where you were born?
Yeah. I'm actually from the east of the country. My place of origin is in Kenema, but I was born in Kono on the 19th of January, 1985. That was my birthday.
But you said you grew up in Kenema, is that right?
Well, I grew up in so many places, but I did the whole of my secondary education in Kenema, and I spent part of the primary in the north, in Cambia, and over the last 4 to 5 years, I've actually been in Makeni, that's Bombali to be specific, yes. Probably because of the occupation of my dad, we used to move from places. He was a police officer. And whenever he's moved on, the family has to go along. So I had to tour up to 6 or more districts within the country before I completed secondary and university education.
Was there a place that you liked best to stay as you were growing up?
Yeah, I think Bo happens to be that place.
Okay.
It's a second capital, but for me, it's well planned. Those basic amenities you may need are there. And the mentality of the people in that part of the country, they are very academic. They admire people who want to, you know, push up with education. So those are aspects that are, for me, very, very motivating, because it's like a community pushing you to be what you want to be. So that would be the one time I'll call.
Gotcha. So as you went through secondary school, I think you said that was in Kenema, right?
Yes.
What kinds of subjects started to really catch your interest?
I started off strong in the science-related subjects right from the early secondaries. And then we had special offices in the school, which we normally call the CAR office. It's an office that follows the student from the day you enter. So they used to assess us on key areas, and they would give you some advice that would encourage your improvement. And going forward, I felt the sciences seemed to be getting easier for me. So many people used to grumble with the sciences, and because they keep telling me you could be good at this, I think that was the inspiration. That was where it all started. Yeah, right from the school.
So, when you were graduating from that school, what did you think you wanted to do with your life?
Already, even before I got to what we call SST, that was the final stage where you sit to an external exam, I had already made up my mind that, considering the foundation I built and my motivation to help others, probably I should find myself in one of the professional courses, either doing engineering or some aspect of medicine. So that was where the ball started. Yeah, I felt the motivation I had, plus that of the academic background, I could take it to any of those points, which for us was meant for, one would say, good students. So I think that was where the motivation came from.
Can you tell me again, was it Injala that you enrolled in immediately after?
Yes, okay. Yes, I did a 3 to 4 years course in Injala. They've got their medical wing that is stationed in Bo, just like you've got commerce being part of the University of Sierra Leone. Injala too has got its medical wing. It's actually in Bo in a campus called Paramedica. That was where I read the community health program I told you about initially.
Sorry, I think you did mention this briefly, but what made you choose medicine over engineering?
Well, actually, I was in a class of very hardworking PPUs, and I think I was fortunate to be part of that team, because it is now the bulk of us are either engineers or in the medical field. And somebody I used to compete with most, you know, we just resolved that we all can run into the same field. But then I had that passion to go beyond just innovation or drawing things or getting things done to even having an impact on lives. So I decided to go the other way. But then the bulk of my class are actually in the engineering field.
Yeah. Gotcha. So, I mean, did you enjoy medical school and the community health program?
I think that's the reason why I'm here, because when I did the course in Jala, I had to manage a whole chiefdom. And with the 3 or 4 years exposure I got, I felt like I could give more, but then I felt limited. So that was the motivation that drove me back. Some of my friends felt, you've already done 4 years in university, you've been in the field, you're working, why go for another 8 or more years? But then the motivation was stronger than, you know, the sort of negative thought that you're coming up. And probably because I had already gone there and I started doing something that I wished to do way back in secondary school.
Yeah. What year was it that you graduated from Injala?
2008. Yes.
Okay.
And I came here 4 years later, 2012.
In those 4 years, were you doing that community health work?
Yes. I was actually manning a whole chiefdom, and basically my job was to see patients and decide which one needs referral to the hospital, which one should be kept at that level and managed, and primarily act as a surveillance person so that if there is any unusual condition, I should be the one to detect that in that chiefdom as soon as possible and then ask for appropriate response. So basically that was what I was doing over that 4 years. And some part into the third year, the office in charge of managing all the other facilities, because at district level, you have the management team that's in charge of the facilities. They felt that I was doing too much for that chiefdom, and they needed that knowledge to roll over to the other chiefdoms. So I was asked to come and join the team in McKinney, and then scale over those experience to the other chiefdoms, because they had 13 chiefdoms and I was only working in one. So when I came down to the district, I could now go down to the 13 chiefdoms and do similar thing I was doing in that chiefdom. So over the last 4 years, that was what I was doing.
So when they had you, kind of, it sounds like you were advising the other chiefdoms. What kinds of
actually,
direction were you getting?
They brought me in to act as a district surveillance officer then. And in that capacity, it's like they will detect the cases in those communities, but then they will have to communicate to you. And then you will now have to mobilize the district on how to respond to those cases. So that gave me the opportunity of going to all of the 13 chiefdoms instead of only the one where I used to be. Probably that was the reason why they had to bring me over. In that process, I had to do some M&E job and to act as focal persons in other programs like malaria. So it was a learning opportunity for me.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Are there some experiences doing that really stand out when you look back?
Yeah. You know, our program is being funded by international agencies, like Global Fund. So there was a time when there were difficulties in handling some of those information. So because I had worked at the facility level, and I knew how those reports would be generated. My boss was at the office then felt that though I was brought in for surveillance, I could be helpful, you know, with areas like the malaria work. So because of that, I became interested in data. So of late, I've been mixing some of my clinical skills with data related. And that was even why my initial entry point into Ebola was the data side. It was only later that the clinical aspect became known. Yeah.
Gotcha. Sorry, I'm writing some of this down.
Yeah, no problem.
So in 2012, was it that you came to Freetown to start medical school? Is that?
Yes.
Gotcha. Okay. Yes. So and you were doing that when Ebola happened, I suppose.
I was, yes.
Can you tell me about when Ebola started circulating in the region and your experience of watching that happen and watching it come to Sierra Leone?
Yeah. Actually, before the infection started here, it had already crossed over to Liberia somewhere in May of around 2013-14. But then I was doing my premier two, we call it premier two here, moving towards, because in Sierra Leone, the first 2 years is some sort of an introductory. It's only after that that you will now start the actual years. So if somebody says he's going to read medicine for 6 years, then he should be coming directly from the college, probably with a first degree. So I was in first year when it all started. I think for us here, it was somewhere around April going down to May. But because it was in the Far East, I think, I don't know what to say, but it seems it wasn't taken up that seriously. Because I could remember even in Freetown, there were people who felt they were just making up stories, and it wasn't even something that should be worried about. But then I have been in the system when we've handled some few outbreaks. I was in Bombali when Lassa fever was a concern. They've never known Lassa fever. They've got their own opinion about Lassa. So when I heard about Ebola, and coincidentally the doctor who was in charge of those viral conditions then, Dr. Khan, I had worked with him as a student. So I knew that it was something serious. But honestly, those early days when it was in the Far East, it wasn't taken seriously. We were having lectures, hand washing and the others were neglected. It was only the latter part of the academic year, that very year, that we realized it was getting out of hands.
Gotcha. I want to interrupt you because can you tell me a bit more about your involvement in Bombali in that Lassa fever situation and also getting to know Dr. Khan a bit?
Actually, I'd been in surveillance a while, and one benefit I got was a training with the CDC program. They used to come, and there was a year when they came, and they started training surveillance officers on field epidemiology. It was called FLTP, and I was a benefactor. So after that training, with the knowledge we got, when we went back, something funny used to happen in the district. But then the people there had got this mentality that it was witchcraft or black magic. So people would die, and probably they'll have blood oozing from their nose or the ear, and they would say, well, maybe he was shot in the head with a black magic. But then when we went back with the knowledge we got from that CDC training, we decided that now that we know that these are the signs of Ebola, Lassa, and people are presenting with this, probably it's a misconception. Maybe out of curiosity, let us try a sample or two. Coincidentally, the DMO that was there then had worked in Kenema. And we know Lassa to be in the east. It was not known to be in the north or even the western area. So he too was curious, and he said it makes sense for us to take a sample. That was when we actually realized that those dead that were associated with black magic had something to do with Lassa. In fact, the team came, they did some trapping of the mastomys rat, and we realized that 8 out of every 10 could actually be a potential carrier. I think going forward, it was agreed that Lassa is no longer an issue of the east. It could now be of the north or even of the west. So I was in that outbreak, that was around 2010. But then because the knowledge was there and we had started earlier, it was contained in a very short time. See. Also, within the same period, we had cholera outbreak around 2010. Some CDC folks also came in. So primarily within Bombali, my job has been surveillance and giving support to that of the M&E with the data-related aspect. And with regards to the doctor I told you about, when I was reading my medical program in Jala, Kenema was one of the referral hospitals for final year students. And I went there. I spent up to 3 months with him. Actually, that hospital is well organized such that they've even got the facility of bringing in students from UK, from US, who will come to understudy the way they work, especially with regards to the LASA program. And they had very interesting facilities. That was even where I was exposed to telemedicine, where you can have your case here being presented to somebody in the UK or in the US, and then you will discuss and they will all contribute to how you will manage certain case. So that was how I met him, Dr. Khan. He was very helpful. And I think for some of us who worked with him, we were able to learn so many skills. He didn't believe in watch me do it. Rather, he will ask you, do it under my supervision. So we acquired so many skills from him. I think it was a big loss to the nation that he was a young man for him to depart that early.
Thank you so much for going into that a bit. So your day-to-day during that time was really surveillance work?
Surveillance.
And so that means that your day-to-day is involved with data mostly, or?
Well, you know, because of the link between surveillance and data itself. Thank you. Yeah. I unavoidably couldn't. You can't be a surveillance officer without handling the data aspect.
Right.
Because you can receive the report, you can go to the field, you can collect whatsoever information. But if you do not put them together and not allow that data to be transformed into information, you won't be able to take appropriate action. So it's as if the drive in surveillance brought me into the data issue. Yeah. Because you go, you do your clinical thing, you collect the information, but then when you compile that and then produce something, you will notice that the thing will be telling you what to do going forward. So it's like my clinical skills taking me to surveillance, and surveillance unavoidably leading me to data. That was how it all started.
Thanks so much for describing that. And you also, I was interested in how you described the community thinking immediately that Lhasa was the result of some sort of witchcraft or something like that.
Yeah.
Does that mean that you also were involved in helping to try and counter those ideas?
Yes.
Like some community education kind of thing?
Yes. Actually, the office where I was brought over had a component that has to do with social mobilization. And their primary job is to receive information that are of interest. And what we are doing then as surveillance officers was, if we go and collect the information, we'll come back, look at what we collected, and see the units that can come in and take action. For example, if there's a potential outbreak, we'll go there, get the data. First, we want to know, is it because of people's perception or people not doing the ID thing? And if it stands out that there's that gap in information, then it will be like the surveillance team telling the social mob that this is the gap, design a message against this. Sometimes we can, if it's say measles, we want to know whether it's because they weren't vaccinated. If they are vaccinated, why are they still showing up? So sometimes we can even tell the team in charge of immunization, we call them EPI, Expanded Program Immunization. We can tell them, maybe you need to look at your cold chain. We got 50 children with measles, and from our data, over 90% of them are immunized. So if the immunization was done accordingly, they shouldn't be coming down with measles. So it's like you sitting there having information that you can provide to various units to work. So basically, that was what we were doing. That was how surveillance was helpful to us.
Perfect. Thank you so much. So sorry, I wanted to, when you said that, that kind of lit up in my brain. So you were describing how at that time there were people in Freetown who didn't think that Ebola was a big deal because it was out east.
Yeah.
Right. Can you take it from there again?
Yeah. I feel probably it was not only in Freetown, probably even in the far north. I think the South didn't have much of that. Probably it's sentiment, but what I know about the South, probably because of their drive for education, people there can think out of the box and they can look at things in a different manner. For me, probably that's why I'm passionate about Bo. But then moving towards the West, people actually were arguing. It was not done secretly. They could sit down in bars and public places saying, oh, this thing is just fake. This is just money making. And even in McKinney, there was a time when a rumor was running around that they had contaminated wells and that was the source of Ebola. So a lot of misconceptions. And I think that was because much education wasn't done then, or maybe people just decided not to trust the story that was coming up, because they were building so many other stories that for me, probably because of my background, that was why I was unable to accept those stories. But then knowing where they are coming from, knowing our illiteracy level, you could tell. But for somebody who can read and write, if we are in the greater majority, I don't think that would have been an issue. But it was, and it was public. People didn't believe until it actually reached part of the Western area here. That was when they knew it was serious.
Do you remember those conversations happening around you with people you knew? Were you engaged in those personal conversations?
Severally. In fact, it just didn't happen among people whom you would have felt were seeing it because they didn't go to school. There are very educated folks whom you expect much from. They were also in it. Because if you could meet a university graduate or a degree holder telling you that this thing is fake, it's just a means of making money. So you could know that it was a concern for me. And it happened within our lecture halls, in public places, with people I knew and I respected. They were all saying it was fake. And probably because I was a little affiliated with the medical team, they could say, you guys are all part of the deal. So no wonder you are in support. So that was how it was like. People didn't take it serious.
So what happened next in your experience?
Because of my link with surveillance, when the outbreak became that worse, the university had to reconsider closing up, because the risk was, if a case comes into a lecture hall and students are interacting, they all will be exposed. And potentially they can take the infection to their various places. And I felt there was no need staying back, that I needed to go back to McKinney and then keep myself busy. Because actually during holidays, I do go down there to assist the team. It's only when we resume lectures that I come back to Freetown. So I went, and that was how involvement into it started. Because then they had also started reporting cases. But then it was just few. But then they had already known that it seems this thing is no longer a joke. But just like I said, because some people didn't believe that it was real, they were not doing things accordingly. There was a village that was almost wiped off because they didn't do things the way we expected. In this village, because they said it was not real, they didn't report any sick individual to the facility that was there. They had a PHE in that town, a health facility, that should assess and do appropriate referral. So what they were doing was, if somebody in house one is sick, they will come and assist to take care of that person. And probably if the individual passed off, they will even do the burial. So they were coming from different places. I think because of people not believing that this thing is real, some villages were wiped out almost completely, see. But then mine started when I actually went there, and because I didn't know much about the disease, it was scary. I didn't want to go into my usual surveillance. So I first started by looking at the data that was coming. That was how my entry into surveillance started.
How were you getting access to that data?
Well, because I had been part of the team and they knew the experience I've had with surveillance. And it has been a routine that during holidays, I'll go there and assist them. So when I showed up, they immediately wanted me to join the team. But I felt the best way to start is to look at the data, see where it's coming from, who are involved. Probably that will give me a better way of entering instead of going into something that even those who are on the ground were scared of, people were not interested to be part of the response. I felt for me coming from a green zone at that stage, I'd already left them doing the work. I didn't know how the whole thing was going, that maybe starting from that point was safe enough for me. So that was how I went into the data aspect.
Yeah. And so what did you do with the data and what did you see?
Well, initially, we didn't have a proper system where we could follow the information right across, because I was telling them that over time we want to know the cases per person, per place and per time. That would be very helpful. But then within a short period while I arrived, the first set of CDC folks also came in and they were highly interested in the data. They needed somebody to team up with them and ensure that every record moving from the district was kept. And the DMO then, who was there, who was the head of the response team, the district medical officer, felt that with the little experience I had, I would be in a better position to help. So I and that team that came actually started the first set of records that was followed. In fact, going forward, our database was transformed into EpiInfo. So we're using EpiInfo to do the inputting for suspected cases, our confirmed cases, and even people that were quarantined. So with that, analysis became very easy. Then we could tell who were involved, which sex is being affected, the communities that are reporting more of the positive cases. I think it was very helpful when we actually had those software. So it's like I went in and within that very month, the first CDC team came in, and that was when we started the data inputting. And that team and the local team that we met was very, very helpful, because then results will come in and there is a positive client, but we'll be arguing, where is this client coming from? Because the labeling then was a little not okay. So we decided that we needed to introduce a unique code, and later that code was copied by every other district. And because of that, we didn't miss any case. Because even if you had the same name, you come from the same community, your code will always be unique to you. So when you are positive, we know even if 10 people have got the same name and the same village, but they will never receive the same unique code. So that innovation that came from the CDC team and the local staff was very, very helpful. Because of that, our district was, right through the response, considered as one of the best. I wouldn't want to say the best, but that was the recommendation we got for some of these innovations. But basically, that was how I came into the response, through the need for data, especially with the increase in demand that came from the CDC team.
So it sounds like one of the issues with the data at first was that it was not easy to determine if two reports were about the same person or not.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Sometimes you can have one report, but then because two people are sharing the same name, you will now be wondering, to whom does this result belong? And the risk there is if you give the result to somebody who is negative, which means you missed the potential case and there's going to be a huge spread out there. See, so that was what brought up the unique code, which for us was the BOM and numbers were followed. And that was very helpful, because with that, even if we don't know your name, because the code has been assigned to you, we know the result is yours.
So can you tell me about some of these people from CDC who came in?
Yeah, I think the very first set of guys that came in, one was, we used to call her Ali. She came with a lady whose background was from one of the I think the South African countries, Zimbabwean, and they were the very first set of folks who came. Dr. Jessica, Dr. Sam. I think the one that we were very glued to was Dr. John Jared. He came in at a time when we really needed to get things done. And fortunately for us, he was on top of the situation. I think a lot of us were a little demotivated. But then when he came in, we seemed to be motivated again because he was interested in results. He was interested in results and we felt we could give it to him. So I think a long list of them, but then the very first team that came and his team were very helpful.
So Dr. John, was he part of the first team or no?
No, he was probably the very set of, around the center of the outbreak, he wasn't part of the first team. He should have been probably the third set of team, because they were coming in batch. They could come for 4 weeks and they would be gone. But then he came as part of the third batch. He actually came for a second time. Initially, he came as a surveillance officer. He went back, and then the second coming was now in a different capacity. I think the last time we saw, he was now the country head for CDC itself. Yeah. So, and I wasn't surprised because the impact he brought and the rate at which he grew within the system, I knew it was related to, you know, what he was doing. And probably that is why it wasn't as if the other CDC folks weren't doing much. But then if you go back to the district and ask for one CDC staff, that's the name you hear, because probably he came at the time that we needed somebody who could think out of the box. Yeah.
So you've described that a couple times, that he came in at a time where you really needed to get things done, where you needed original thinking. What was the situation what was the problem that you needed to solve?
He meant that we've already introduced the database. But unfortunately, there was a huge backlog. So many cases had already been seen that were never entered into that system. And we needed to get that done. But then we only had one laptop. So the issue was, how can you work from different sources and match? First, there was an issue of who knows any method that we can do inputting from 7 or more laptops and match them together. We couldn't solve that issue. He was able to handle that. He was hands on deck. It's as if we have 150 forms, basically they were in pairs. He could say, okay, Francis, you have 50. 50 for me, 50 for the other staff. And because we actually needed that data at that stage, we needed to know what has happened then, where we are now, and what we should do going forward. So that was a huge, huge challenge that he was able to resolve. Second, we had an issue of getting our teams to the field because they needed resources, they needed fuel. And two or three times, there had been delay in people going to the field to investigate cases. And the unfortunate thing is, if you do not get there early, investigate a case and decide that this one should be isolated, it may be a huge mess at the end of the day. See? So the fact that he was also able to come in and assist us with the resources we needed, such as fuel, such as lobbying with other institutions to help us with motorbike, those things were badly needed at that stage. Because these are stages when we've already got our guys with enough knowledge to actually hive out cases. But if they do not get there on time, then they will not be able to isolate a potential case from people who will not be infected. So those are some of the challenges we had. And maybe that was why I said he came in at a time when we needed him most. And he was able to settle those things. And probably those things are very helpful to the district. Going forward.
You mentioned that, excuse me, one of the things was partnering with other organizations.
Yes.
To do things. Can you describe that in a little more detail?
Yes. WHO was very, very active, and along the line, the ministry, with direction from the presidential office, decided to introduce we are calling them command centers. It was a parallel structure purely to handle the Ebola related issues. So the support we are getting from the CDC team, that of the WHO team, and this team that was set up by government, because there are NGOs that are handling health related issues. So all the activities we are now poured into that command center. You see. So I think at that stage, that was when we actually had things well organized, because then we now had a surveillance team that was only doing surveillance. We had a quarantine team, a social mob team. Before then, a single team will move in and do the investigation. We do their isolation, we quarantine, we handle social mob. But when those structures were now established, it's like everybody knows what he or she should do. The surveillance team moves in, establish that this individual needs to be isolated. The quarantine team will move in, identify those who should be isolated. Social mob, they will come in to counsel them, talk to them, and give them a reason why they should observe that 21 days period. So at that stage, when we got all those units on board, I think that was when we really knew what to do. Because initially it was like, we are doing everything. We could decide to go anyway, which for me wasn't good enough initially.
Yeah. I really thank you. That's a brilliant description. And I appreciate your description of what John, Dr. John did. So I appreciated your description of John and the ideas that he brought and the energy that he brought. Do you also have some like personal memories of him that you wouldn't mind sharing?
Yeah. Actually, since that hour when we met, he has been like a mentor to me. We've met on to 3 or 4 more occasions, because I had this. What I believe in is you really need to work hard. And then there is nothing you can't achieve, except if you choose not to work hard. But then in our society, there are times you can be frustrated for doing the right thing. And unfortunately, you can even be frustrated by the person who should be encouraging you to do more. So to have somebody who really knew what should be done and what it is done was a big motivation for me. Personally, he was a friend to me. He was my motivator, a mentor. And before we met, I was already in medical school. But then one thing I used to tell him of late was that he had changed the way I've been handling things, the way I used to do things, my opinion that certain things couldn't be achieved except you go out of the box. You know, he actually changed me to a greater extent. And the first 2 years before I met him, I wouldn't say my performance in medical school wasn't good, but then honestly, the last year or so years since we met, because of the way he was doing things, him being organized, managing time. So what I did was I copied that from him and I took that to the classroom. And honestly, it has been amazing for me. These days, I could handle studies. Once in a while, I could be out there to help with other district job. And it seems as if I'm doing all those things, and I'm still excelling in my academic work. So sometimes I associate the fact that we met and the way he was doing things. For example, when they were there, they had to ensure that the data was in there. They had to ensure that the lab results have come back. They have to ensure that the surveillance officers have got the necessary logistics to go out. They still have to go to the treatment unit. So they needed to attend meetings. So I was seeing one person well organized, getting things done, and I felt it's a learning opportunity for me. So basically, he was like a mentor and a friend. Yeah. And I think the things I learned from him have changed the way I am doing things. And it's my dream that then probably when I'll be done in medical school and probably 1 or 2 postgraduate course, I'll be opportune to work with the CDC. Because I think the people who've come from there, who I've worked with even before the outbreak, right from 2010, right through the Lassa, the cholera outbreak, they have been very motivated. Thank you very much. Maybe because we spent some time with them and we are in the same office, maybe that was why I got to see the other side of them, because the other folks who were coming probably were only for a short time. But on the overall, the impact he had on me and the team was wonderful. And because I was the head of that team, you know, I was just too appreciative of him, you see. Because I went there, the team was on their own. I only went in as a data person, and then later my surveillance skills showed up. But then with all those skills, you wouldn't be able to do much if you do not get the support. And because he came in and the support actually came, he, to a greater extent, helped me to achieve that dream of mine, which was to make our surveillance team a very good team, a solid team. And that's why I think me and my colleagues back in McKinney are very grateful to have met him. And his hard work was so much that one of the surveillance team members called me and he said he had got a request from one of the chiefdoms that the folks that our friend that was working with us, they think he should be naturalized as a Sierra Leonean. And I told them, an American to become a Sierra Leonean citizen. But actually, that chiefdom will have gone down the drain if the motivation he brought wasn't there. But we had to argue with the paramount chief, and he told us the only thing I can accept is to crown your friend as one of our local chiefs. He was adamant. And we said, well, we haven't got any option. However, we need his consent. So you could just see the impact he had, not only on us, but even stakeholders out there who knew when he started, and they saw a sudden change. So they wanted to know, you know, why the improvement? Yes, the ministry was doing its own, other people were doing theirs, but they realized that there are also people who were out there in the field, who were making the move. So even without us telling them, these stakeholders picked on some of them, and he was one. The other lady was from WHO. The two of them were really, really active. And I think he could still remember that lady. She's also an American. Maybe it's part of the American dream. She's Allison Connolly. They were together almost, I think they came together around the same time. And in our daily surveillance meeting, they normally used to, you know, bring the ideas. And sometimes the ideas wouldn't want to agree. We have to say, okay, let us ignore this for now, come tomorrow. But then the two of them were so, so helpful. And I don't know whether it was a coincidence. That chiefdom, I think the lecturer is here. That chiefdom picked on the two of them.
Okay, and we're back. I think that, Francis, you had just been talking about something that the district did for Dr. Allison and Dr. John.
Yeah. Actually, like I said earlier on, the request didn't come directly from the district team. It came from people in these communities whom they were working with. Because part of their job was not just to coordinate issues in the office, they also used to accompany us going to the field. And back then, because we had 13 chiefdoms, we had placed our surveillance teams into groups. And sometimes if they have difficult cases that they come back and inform the team, the CDC or WHO team will want to go and join the investigation themselves and see how difficult it will be to unravel. Because sometimes when we have positive cases, the first question that will come will be, what's the source of this infection? We know Ebola is a contact disease. So somebody just can't be positive. We need to know where the individual got the disease from. And because our team, they weren't thoroughly trained, they weren't professional, so they had difficulties. That was how Dr. John and Dr. Allison had to come in, because they used to go to the field. So it's like the community people knew them because they were very frequent. And when the entire outbreak came to an end, they started asking after them. They were saying, where are those your colleagues, the ones that used to come here with you people? We want to see them again. But then we used to tell them, you know, they come on rotational basis. It was only, I think the two of them stayed a little longer, because Dr. John was going and coming back at them in different capacities. So the request actually came from them, and then we were a little doubtful. We felt maybe they wouldn't buy it, they wouldn't buy the idea. But then we had to communicate to them because it wasn't coming from us, it was coming from the community. So that was how it happened. And both requests came from the same chiefdom. Maybe because the other was a lady, they felt we needed a man. And that chiefdom, like I told you earlier on, had it not been for those interventions, it would have been a big, big issue for them. See? So they felt that there was nothing they could do. They couldn't give them money. They couldn't probably ask them to come and stay. Maybe the only thing they could do is, and that's a very, very huge honor for you to be crowned as a chief. Even us, the local people, cannot be given that opportunity easily. Giving that to you is like giving their all. See, we knew the gravity of that, but it was not our decision, so we had to communicate with them. And we are lucky that they agreed, that they consented, because it's like the community thinking that we'll do all our best to convince them. So if they had told us we wouldn't be able to go, we wouldn't want to be engaged in that, it will have been difficult for us to, you know, persuade those communities. But at the end of the day, we too, we are very much proud because we knew what they did. And the fact that the community is now acknowledging that in that special manner, I think it was all a feather on our cap. We were so happy for them. And I think that's why those events will be part of our memory, probably right through life.
Were you there those days? When
I was there when the lady was crowned. And for the captain, being a friend and a mentor, I was in trouble that day. That was the day I had to write my anatomy exams. The only thing I told him was, I think I have to give in my all to this exam, because that's the only way I could, you know, tell you how grateful I am. And again, another coincidence. That academic year, we did three subjects. I got three distinctions. So I was so happy, and I said, maybe this is a compensation to my friend for not witnessing that crowning ceremony. I had to share the result with him. And maybe that was just me knowing I would not be going there because of this exam. And so the only thing I have to do is to give in my best. And I wish I was there. But then my colleagues were there, and the impression I got was it was really fantastic. And I think I was satisfied with them, what I had from them and even from Dr. John himself.
Right, thank you. I wanted to go back to something, and this is something you said earlier. When the CDC people first came and you started to use EpiInfo, the hemorrhagic fever database, was that a smooth transition? Was it easy to do?
It wasn't. It wasn't, because like I said earlier on, there was a huge pile. There was a gap in knowledge. People were not using this. Even the normal, they were using more or less paper-based, that the information comes to them in some form of a paper and it's filed. See? So to move that from a paper-based all into a computer, first you needed to give them the knowledge. They needed to be willing and determined to do it. You needed to go back and do the backlog. And that was the time when we now started having just confirmed cases in the 50s. You could throw in 100 or so samples, and then 50 or so will come back positive. And then you have to ensure that before the results are back, those informations are already in the system. See, the only challenge then was because we needed to catch up with, you know, the old data that had been processed. In fact, sometimes we even had to go to certain communities just to find out, because there were missing information and we needed to get our database clean. But then when we finally succeeded in getting that up to date, and with the support we are having from the other teams, it was smooth. There was a time when it was made such that you could even be in one corner, you can access the database, you can do your input in. We only had password to it so that only people who needed to access the data could, because we didn't want anyone to come in and just read that data. But before the AP Info, there was no proper recording. Upon introduction of the AP Info, the challenge was going back, ensuring that all those information that are kept in files are inputted, and then the human resource to get that done, such that, in fact, the CDC had to hire some staff whom they paid just to give support to us, because we are working on the side of ministry. But then the workload was too much because we needed to catch up. So they hired individuals whom they paid. And those guys, again, were very helpful, because now we have somebody whom at least could coordinate the input in, because that's his job. So I think that stage, the transition was tough, and we expected that. But going forward, it was smooth. And that data was very helpful to us all.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that. Can I ask, throughout your Ebola response, do you remember applying any instances where you were able to apply lessons that you had learned from dealing with Lhasa?
Yes. Yeah. Probably knowing the fact that the way they could be transmitted, it's the same, and the fact that both of them are very virulent, they could kill somebody if the care is not taken. So those are very good learning opportunities. In fact, the experience that we got from that one, and the fact that the Ebola itself was something else, made us very strict with our guys. There are times when we couldn't compromise with them. Any surveillance officer do not adhere even to a simple dress code. We did agree that if you are going to the field, there is a way you should be dressed. Even though you are a surveillance officer, we don't expect you to go and come in contact with the cases, but we expect you to be a little dressed. Like, people will want to come with some sort of an easy wear with their feet exposed.
Like sandals of some sort?
Yes, we didn't allow those. In fact, again, because of the support we are getting from these teams, they did provide those footwears were good enough, because even if by coincidence somebody throws up and the vomitors come in contact with you, you'll be confident that it will get in touch with your skin and you may not be infected. See? So the knowledge you got from the Lhasa outbreak and the information we got over time from WHO, CDC on how Ebola itself will be transmitted, the precautions to take, those are all very, very helpful. And we are lucky that though the people that are coming in, well, we'll say we are foreigners, but then they were a little firm with us, especially the lady, because sometimes the men, they may tend to do it nicely, but ladies will be very much firm. And Allison was one of that type. If she sees you in that manner, she's saying you won't be part of, because every morning we have a briefing meeting before going out. You will not be part of that meeting. You have to go back home. Either you stay home for that day, or you go back and get the agreed dress code. And I think that was very good, because it was only our team that didn't get any casualty right through the exercise. We had colleagues from the other end who were victims. Even ordinary people who are just going there to find out whether cases we are doing fine, we used to call them contact tracers. Few of them became victims. See, I wouldn't say negligence or so, but maybe for us, because of the people who had around us, and they didn't just see us as people who are working with them, but they saw us as part of them, and they did their best to ensure that we are fine. I think that was very helpful.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What do you see for your future? Are you going into practice medicine? Or are you going to continue with public health in some way?
I think it's going to be a mixture of that. That's, in fact, the drive that brought me. I didn't just want to go into public health without a solid clinical background, because I felt my passion is to read epidemiology going forward. I don't want to be involved in research that are medical related. And I felt, though I got some medical background then, I didn't just think it was good enough to take me to that level that I want to be.
So going forward, when I shall have completed, I will still want to maintain some of my clinical practice, but with that aspect of public health coming in. And maybe that's where the match between me and most of the doctors coming from CDC seems to be in agreement. Yeah. Because if you know what is happening in the clinic, and then you want to do some investigations, or you'll be better placed than you just coming from the other end and not knowing what is happening in there. So that's the drive. That's my wish.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share, like a memory or a reflection before we conclude the interview?
Yeah, I think there was one scary moment during the outbreak.
Yeah.
A colleague of us was sick. And again, that's where the leadership of Dr. John stands out. Because a lot of the other colleagues that were around, they panicked and didn't handle the issue well, but we are lucky that he was around. This guy was experienced in signs related to, I would say Ebola, because then malaria-related signs we are seen as Ebola-related. He is one of our key surveillance officers. We were in the office the whole of that day. He had been experiencing this weakness. He didn't tell anyone. What he did was, he talked to the guy transporting samples from the lab, and his blood was collected and sent. We didn't know, because routinely it would have been a surveillance officer getting a form ready for him. Because he was part of us, he made that form and the sample went. The result came because then CDC had already designed the way such that we can get our results the very day. We used to throw in our results and we would have to wait for 48 hours or so. But with the new speed that came, the fact that we are having access to vehicle, access to fuel, sample could be sent in the morning, and there was a CDC lab in Bowden, we could receive back our results soon. The result came in the evening, we saw the name, but nobody could claim that I prepared the form, so we needed to know whether it was him. It was pending, actually, it was in the red, but they said not to that extent that they could declare the result to be Ebola positive. So all of us were in that office, including the CDC staff. In fact, that very day, the guy was helping us with data inputting. He was in touch with us. Everybody panicked. Fortunately for us, Dr. John was around. The other colleague was a WHO staff. He was a Russian by background. He was so shocked that when finally the whole thing was resolved, he, in fact, decided he was going back. But fortunately for us, Dr. John immediately arranged for a second sample to be collected that very evening, and he was able to persuade the guy to be isolated. I think if he had panicked then, maybe all of us would have just taken the back seat thinking we are exposed, we are infected, wouldn't have got a way around that. I think that moment was one that it was scary that day, but these days when we meet and share that fun, I think we just laugh over it. But it was, and we needed a leader that day. And I think fortunately for us, we had one. Otherwise, I don't know whether that would have destabilized us. And it happened to people who really were handling the outbreak at that level, because it was we on the side of the local team, they on the side of the external team. So if those two teams, for any reason, tear apart, we will have been in a mess. Yeah. But that one is an event. I even can't describe it in a more better manner. I wish there was a video of that event that day. Yeah. Because it was like everybody running helter-skelter thinking, oh, I've been exposed. Ebola has been out there. Finally, it has come. And we are in touch with it today, you know. But we are so grateful to, God and to the people who had around us that day. And the guy is still there. He's now a key staff in social mobilization. And he's very helpful. He read public health and he graduated 2 years back. See, so these days when I go back to McKinney, I will say it seems as if you may have beating Ebola, the fact that you are tested, your result came pending, maybe you are actually exposed. And unfortunately, we haven't got those facilities. But left with me, I think a guy like that, they need to probably take some sample, find out what really happened. Maybe he was actually exposed and by chance was able to develop immunity against the disease. But it was a very, very scary moment.
Yeah. I know you need to rush off back to class, but anything, was there anything else that you wanted to share for the historical record before we end?
I think I've said all. All I will say is I only hope the CDC that has been introduced for Africa could be as hardworking and as focused as the one in the US. Because I was reading through and I had one has been established for CDC Africa. Because to me, this team has been very, very helpful to us. Not just sending personnel, but even the knowledge they've been giving us. And because had they not been giving us those knowledge, people like us wouldn't have known and probably wouldn't have even established by now that Lassa fever could not just be associated with the East. Because people, the moment they hear Lassa fever, they will tell you, no, that one has to do with Kenema, or that one has to do with Kailan. But because of those knowledge that we got from them, you know, we came back, and those knowledge were very, very helpful. So for me, if that partnership will be sustained, such that agencies back here who wants to act in the capacity of bodies like CDC could just, you know, learn from them because they've been in the system for a while, I'm sure going forward, you know, our country will be really good. And when I did that course with CDC, one strong recommendation I did in the research work was that if we can institutionalize some of those courses, you know, like in Sierra Leone, we don't train epidemiologists. Yes, we do some public health, but I think there are some things that should be introduced into our curriculum because those things will really make us better prepared. See, if not, the conditions will be there, we wouldn't be able to do much. See. So in my opinion, the support they've been giving us, not only in human resource, but even in improving on the knowledge of people, have been very, very helpful, and I'm a benefactor of that. See. I went there as a mere student assisting, but because of that background I had from them, I ended up being my position was so big that I was saying, no, you shouldn't give me this position. This position is not going to change anything, you know. But then I think the only motivation I have is, you know, I know those experiences that I've got and the people I've met, the changes they've made in my life, it's just a start. And that's why I appreciate CDC, their staffs, and they are special. I think that's what I would say. In my district, there is a chiefdom where even the local people, even Sierra Leoneans, they don't go there easily. A CDC staff went down there. You know, those are some of the motivations I got. One of the doctors that came, one Dr. Jessica, she went as far as, we call that place Tambaka. In the first place, you have to go across the ferry. There is no network. It's a whole chiefdom, very big, but very, very remote. We started having two or three Ebola cases from that chiefdom, and we all panicked because we knew the terrain. We knew anything beyond that, we'll be in trouble. See, even where some of our doctors can't go, she went there, she stayed there, and she was very helpful to our guys. Those sort of motivations we got from that team, I think those are days we'll never forget. We still remain very appreciative of them. Their names will always be in our memory. You know, there's a long list of them. I will have run through that, but I think that's what I want to end with. We will always remember the CDC team, and I'm sure going forward, those of us who have worked with them and the knowledge we've got, we'll use that to impact lives, and we'll always make reference to the fact that it was with their support that we got those knowledge.
Thank you very much, Mr. Francis Abu Bayor.
Thank you. You're welcome.